Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And it's my honor to welcome back Michelle Flournoy, the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, now the co-founder and managing partner of West Exec Advisors, a strategic advisory firm. She's also the co-founder of the Center for a New American Security and is widely considered a leading candidate to become a future Secretary of Defense. And she is joined by Gabrielle Sheffitz, a senior associate at West Exec and somebody who is someday going to be defense secretary as well. Gabrielle, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Vago, for having me.
A pleasure. You guys are the authors of a very thoughtful report released recently by CNAS, Sharpening the U.S. Military's Edge, Critical Steps for the Next Administration. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, and of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. The reason I think this report is so good is it was not written from the lens of an acquisition expert, but the perspective of strategists with policy, force planning, and force planning backgrounds that also understand sort of how the Pentagon works at a base level. And so I commend our audience to really read it because it's brief, well-written, and packed with a lot of very practical recommendations. Michelle, let's start with you, right? The report starts out with a hammer blow to the forehead. The United States is losing its military technological advantage vis-a-vis great power competitors such as China. We're basically in a situation where you outline sort of the Pentagon does what it does because it's always done it. And yet there's a recognition that programs aren't matched to threats. The progress has been incremental, even though everybody has a sense of urgency. And now we're sort of out of time and out of money, which is exactly sort of where you don't want to be. And you make the case that it's time to change our thinking, organization, resourcing, and really improve technical skills. Before I get you to start talking about the solution, just give us sort of a brief explanation of the problem.
Sure. So we all talk about being in a period of great power competition, and that has many dimensions. First and foremost, economic competition, technological competition, diplomatic and political competition. But there is also, of course, a military dimension. And the name of the game in that dimension, in my view, is deterring conflict between two nuclear powers. And to do that, we have to demonstrate resolve to defend our interests and our allies, but we also have to demonstrate that we have the military advantage no matter what an aggressor might do. If we take China as the pacing threat, we need to be able to convince them that we have the military capabilities to either deny the success of any aggression, deterrence by denial, or impose such costs that they have to recalculate because the costs aren't worth the benefit of the aggression. The problem is, if we just go forward with the planned force, we are likely to lose that edge and lose our confidence in our ability to deter or defeat Chinese aggression in the future. And it's difficult to overstate the catastrophic consequences of the altered balance of power that would result. You know, a United States that could no longer credibly protect its interests, allies, and partners in the very region, the Indo-Pacific, on which the future prosperity and security of Americans will depend most in the coming century. So this is a huge challenge. And what we are trying to do in the report is, first of all, kind of sound the alarm, as others have, and take stock of where are we. You know, to be fair, the department's done a lot of good things. There are a lot of good efforts being made, but we're not moving with the speed and scale that is necessary to meet the objective. And so that's where we tried to focus our recommendations of what more needs to be done.
You argue that this is rightfully a question of leadership in the department, leadership up on Capitol Hill as well, and lawmakers can be an awesome partner at the end of the day once they understand fully the stakes and the department explains it. How do we need to change fundamentally our mindset of how we're thinking about threats and how we address them so that we develop the kind of concepts and programs that actually are matched to that threat and now also have to do it on a budget. What's sort of the macro solution before we dive into the specifics?
Well, I think the first thing is we really do have to focus on deterrence as a primary objective and think about it in two timeframes. The immediate timeframe of how do we use what we have differently in new ways that will bolster deterrence. And then mid to long term, you know, what are the key capabilities we're going to invest in to add to our legacy force? Because even if you make some big trades, the bulk of the force will still be legacy systems for decades to come. And so the question is, what are the emerging technologies and capabilities you add into the mix to enable new ways of operating and better outcomes? And we have to think asymmetrically. And this is the really hard part. We're so used to assuming that we will have air superiority, you know, maritime superiority, space superiority, and that we will have it early and that we will keep it. And the biggest change about the future security environment in any conflict with a China or a Russia is that is no longer a safe assumption. We are going to have to perform in very lethal contested environments where you'll gain advantage and for a while and then you'll lose it and you have to regain it and so forth. And that requires a very different approach to fighting and a very different mindset in terms of developing new capabilities and concepts that are constantly seeking that competitive advantage against a power that may have the home advantage and may also have quantitative superiority vis-a-vis our forces and in certain measures. So that's the first mindset change. The second is this has to be the top priority for DoD's investment. I think there's a lot of level, you know, if DoD loves to measure things by level of effort, you know, there's a very high level of effort already happening in the department, but we're not getting the outcomes, you know, we need. And so I think you need leaders who come in with this as a clear priority, that develop a shared agenda as a team across OSD and the services, and then just, drive that agenda every single day and incent people to get on board, hold people accountable when they don't. It really has to be a different level of focus and realignment of resources and talent with the objective you're trying to achieve.
Gabrielle, let me bring you into the conversation here, because as Michelle said, or you're hinted at, was that great powers also have a tendency of sort of mirror imaging one another. China fields hypersonic weapons, we have to develop hypersonic weapons. America has aircraft carriers, we as China have to develop aircraft carriers. It always makes sense to steal good ideas from adversaries, but at the end of the day, I think part of the argument that you guys are making is that it's also vitally important to completely think differently about concepts. And the question is, what's the right approach for us to get to that concept development where we're the ones coming up with these innovative concepts and we're testing them at scale? Because right now when we do a test, it's sort of a boutique test. Or even when we say we're going to put a squadron of LCS ships, littoral combat ships aside for development testing, we decide like, well, we're just going to get rid of those ships, for example. Right. What's the right approach for us to take to develop these innovative warfighting concepts that we need in the future? In a future, as Michelle, I think, rightly says, advantage will be measured by days or by minutes or by hours, not by years.
Yeah, no. So I think that this is a really important point. And in the paper, we really try to stress the importance of operational concepts and make clear that innovation is not just about technology. This is how we think more innovatively and pair both new and legacy capabilities, as Michelle said, to fight in a fundamentally new and different way. And not just respond, but think proactively about how we are going to bolster our deterrence, strengthen our advantages, and kind of undermine the enemy's weaknesses. And that we really can't just expect to acquire new technologies and pair them with old concepts and produce this new result and way of fighting. And so to kind of invest more in operational concept development is critical, but it's going to take several things. So first and foremost, it's going to take leadership making this a big issue of bolstering deterrence and shoring up the U.S. military edge. It's a primary focus, and then investing resources in the capabilities that are needed to do this. So first and foremost, it is kind of the top level department leadership, as well as the service leadership, making this a priority, and then helping others kind of see and buy into this fundamental shift in thinking. That's one of the reasons concept development is just so important. It can show kind of where the threats are, where we are failing, and why it is so critical that we reimagine the way that we fight. The second thing is about investing in more wargaming, new virtual and mixed reality simulations, and just doubling down on operational analysis and experimentation. And what we argue is that this concept development, when combined with robust operational analysis, is really how you first build buy-in for this shift in mindset and culture, and how you can really accelerate technological adoption. So if you are developing these new concepts, then it helps better understand what technologies you're actually going to need to operationalize those concepts and bring this vision to reality. And ultimately, that's what matters most. And then second is, can you do the rapid, robust experimentation, operational analysis to help refine the requirements for these technologies and iterate over time, making sure that you have the capabilities you need? And that, we argue, is crucial to accelerating technological adoption and really, really driving down development timelines and making sure that we have the operator feedback and that connection between concept development, experimentation, and operations that is going to make sure that we have the right technologies that we need to actually fight in this way and get them in the hands of the operator quickly and at scale. And then just one other piece of this that I think is critical is that relationship with Congress. So much of this rides on the ability for DoD to have a certain number of prototypes to actually do these real world experiments and test these concepts of operation. And we continue to find ourselves in a bit of a catch-22 where, you know, Congress will say that it doesn't want to fund these prototypes because it wants better clarity about how the department is going to use them, what the requirements are going to be. While DoD and the services are saying, you know, we need a certain number of these prototypes to actually figure out how we are going to do these concepts and what the requirements are going to be. And so one of the key points in the report that we try to make is really that it is critical for so many reasons, but this one in particular, to really reimagine this relationship with Congress, build trust between the sides. And so you have Congress taking more risk, being willing to take the risk and give DoD a certain number of prototypes, which will be so critical to fueling this concept development and operational analysis work that we believe is critical.
But how do you align this, right? So if you go to the services now and you ask them, they would say, like, well, that's exactly what we're doing. But at the end, you find that virtually everybody is working against actually getting coordinated because everybody's doing their own thing. If you're a heritage defense contractor, and I'm not trying to paint blame on major companies, but it's like, look, I've got a lot in this weapon system. It's been here for decades. It's part of my strategy for another few decades. The last thing I want is to be displaced in that. As a consequence, you know, we've seen competition after competition after competition to try to eventually get to where the service wants to go to for a whole variety of reasons. The services work against one another on a regular basis, in part because of turf reasons and what have you. And then, of course, you've got lawmakers who don't want to see some of these systems go out of service as well, or new concepts of operation, right? So the whole system is sort of incentivized to slow everything down and monetize time effectively. What are some ways to actually accelerate this system, right? To actually, you know, or is it, Michelle, I mean, is it just a simple leadership question that somebody's got to take the bull by the horns and shepherd everyone to a better place?
Well, there is certainly that. But, you know, I think part of it is, you know, especially with the devolution of so much acquisition authority to the services, it means that you need more leadership to coordinate at the sort of strategic and conceptual and oversight level in OSD. And I do think that means first, as I said, having a Secretary of Defense make this clearly the department's top investment priority, and really announce the number of big bets. And, you know, we could have a whole, you know, segment of your podcast debating what those big bets should be. But we gave a few examples or candidates in our report, such as a secure, resilient C4ISR network of networks that can support the joint force in an A2AD environment. You know, AI-enabled decision support to ensure our commanders can make better decisions faster than the adversaries. Fleets of integrated autonomous systems that can team with manned platforms to perform, you know, critical functions at lower risk. You know, and there's a good list in the report there. But say you name a number of these things, and the department has named a number of technology priorities, but the next step has not been taken, and that is really realign resources, meaning make significant multi-year, you know, statements of intent about moving, you know, resources into these big bet areas. And then you put a team in place, and a team that can operate as a team. This is one of the struggles that OSD has had recently. You have a mix of leaders who are not functioning together, driving towards a common objective, and a lot of tensions between parts of OSD and the services. But choosing a team of leaders as a team, being very clear on who's responsible for what, and accountability, holding them accountable, and then devoting considerable senior leader time and bandwidth to this project. I think that something that an earlier administration got right, they had this Advanced Capabilities and Deterrence Panel, I think it is. Deputy Secretary Work and the Vice Chairman co-chaired this. Something like that needs to be reinstituted at the deputy level to drive the oversight of technology development and operational concepts and organizational reform efforts to actually push this agenda every single day. And I think that is the one of the mechanisms or the key mechanism for getting sort of unity of effort that we are not seeing today. The other thing I do think is that, you know, the best way to get real innovation, whether it's in technology or in concepts, is some form of competition. And I think one of the things that I've watched the Air Force do, and I think they're onto something, is these connectathons. I know they have a new name and I'm forgetting what that is, but you know, it's basically the every, you know, 4 months or so, they're saying, let's demonstrate connecting shooters and sensors directly and performing certain missions. And that is a tremendous incentive for some of the more traditional providers to come to the table and say, we want to play too. You know, we want to, you know, move towards open mission systems and be able to, you know, connect certainly everything we produce as a company, but also be able to connect with things that others produce. But I think you can create certain fora and incentives to get everyone to try to play if they believe that that's going to get them the opportunity to really compete seriously for these big bets that you place.
Gabrielle, let me. That brings us to the Valley of Death, the vaunted Valley of Death. You know, the United States has always been a leader in driving game-changing innovation and delivering it at scale and at speed, right? I mean, you guys stress this repeatedly in the report, and I think everybody understands that it's great to have a better mousetrap, but if you only have like four mousetraps, that's not perhaps as important in a room full of mice. Anyway, you get the analogy. But and this is more important than ever with a very, very sophisticated, savvy competitor like China that can actually deliver innovation at scale. The Valley of Death is been something that folks have been talking about tackling, and it's just not worked, where the time it takes to take a brilliant idea and execute it, companies die, ideas die, momentum dies, and technology gets outdated, right? So you may have had a good mousetrap, you just never got it out fast enough. Gabrielle, what's the way to bridge this and to get innovation at scale and speed?
Yeah. So as you note, I mean, this is a tremendous challenge. And when we looked back in the report and said, you know, the administration has committed itself to this effort, it is starting to make steps at the margin, but why are we not getting that innovation at speed and scale? So much of it comes back to this valley of death problem. And so we really look at why this is and kind of how you get after it. And so the first thing, as Michelle said, it's really about that leadership and big bets and where can you realign resources, make a multi-year statement of intent. So can you have the department saying, you know, over the next few years, here is where we are going to make these investments. You signal to both the services that there is this change coming and to investors and innovative companies that the department is willing to put real resources and create a roadmap for what its priorities are and send a big and important signal in that way. Second, you know, there's this gap between these, you know, innovative organizations, the DIUs, AFWERX, SOFWERX, that are responsible for getting some of these new companies in the door in the first place. And then the program managers that are the ones that will ultimately be responsible for major programs. And so we argue that you need much earlier engagement and a much stronger connection between these entities. So you have companies engaging with the ultimate buyer earlier and they don't get caught in that dreaded valley. And another thing is just kind of coordination and transparency. There's so much siloing, you know, as we know, in the department. So a new company can come in with a solution and be doing great work for one service or COCOM or even section of those and be completely unknown to other entities that are looking to solve that same problem. And so if you even had an inventory of companies working with the department, the solutions they're offering to specific problems, and that way other entities and organizations can be able to access those solutions more quickly and really help scale in that critical way. And then finally, we make a recommendation about DOD and Congress working together to perhaps authorize bridge funding. And you know, what we found in companies that we work with, take for example, if you're an AI company and you've won a prototype contract, let's say in 2019, and you're getting funding and doing good work with a service, and then DOD turns around and says to you, okay, this is great, we really like you, we'd like to buy more, and we're going to put you in the budget in 2021 for a program contract. You know, many of these small companies can't stand a loss of revenue for a year to a year and a half. And so how does DOD, working with Congress, think through providing perhaps bridge funding that can allow for development and refinement of those capabilities in the interim on a competitive basis and bridge that gap? And as you say, you know, with China and its unique ability, given its model, a notion of civil-military fusion, able to access, integrate, scale technology so quickly, having our own response, one that is a democratic capitalist that respects the divide between government and private sector, but kind of harnesses the best of each is so critical. And we need to show companies, show investors that there is a real path to working with the department and one that is scalable and with real profit to be had.
If I could just add one other idea we put out. So, one of the things that some of the services have done, the Army in particular, is they've tried establishing cross-functional teams to bring, you know, the requirements writers, the acquirers, the program managers, the operators together to sort of go after some of these innovative technologies. The challenge is they don't really have the ability to decisively move resources within the portfolio that they are responsible for. So, you know, if you look at the private sector companies that do acquisition at scale and innovation at scale, they have a portfolio management approach, meaning they empower a team that looks across a range of capabilities. And as things, you know, certain capabilities become more promising, you know, they're more cost effective, they're more impactful, they're maturing more quickly, and others that are starting, that have failed or don't look as promising as they are developed, you know, they're able to replace their bets. They're able to reallocate funds within a portfolio to increase the speed of scaling the things that work. We don't allow people to do that. And so the question I have is, you know, can we have a conversation with folks in Congress if it's coupled with a much more closely collaborative approach to allow some degree of reprogramming authority within defined portfolios so that you can get that kind of acceleration of innovation and adoption?
Do you need to have some other form of bridge funding to let people go of technology you no longer need or platforms you no longer need, so that it's not sort of an abrupt tail off? I mean, none of these systems abruptly tail off, right? I mean, it's not like we pack them up and we discard them. But I mean, do you need a different kind of incentive structure, including to let a prime contractor let go, given that they have a fiduciary obligation to their shareholders to push forward their business case? Yeah, and if they can get the department to buy something, they're going to sell it.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think that, you know, this idea is not a fully developed model that has taken into account the business models of the various parts of industry right. that it would affect. So I think but I think those are the kinds of questions we need to explore to see how could we make this work. And I think even the ability to try it, you know, pilot it on a small scale, see if we can get some, you know, see if the department can get some better results, build the confidence in Congress that they'll have the appropriate transparency and the ability to oversee what the department's doing. And, you know, I think it seemed like a best practice, you know, in the private sector that might actually, with some adaptation, work, you know, in the department.
You know, one of the things that has come up, Michelle, in your comments and Gabrielle in yours, is sort of technical expertise. And once upon a time, the Pentagon, I think, clearly was the world's leading technology force. But that's less so. And increasingly now, the Pentagon is in a struggle to even keep pace with commercial technology development, much less identifying it in a timely basis and inserting it into programs. Dr. Carter tried very, very hard when he was secretary to sort of bring Silicon Valley in order to help in that process and to enlist folks like Eric Schmidt and what have you on the Defense Innovation Board. But ultimately, there's a sense that the technical acumen doesn't exist within the Pentagon's walls, and that actually senior leaders aren't as cyber savvy, for example, or even as tech savvy as they need to be given the challenges that we have. Gabrielle, maybe if you want to lead off, what are some ways that the Pentagon can harness a new generation of talent like you to come into the department, given that there are commercial opportunities that are far, far more lucrative than going into the Pentagon and, you know, working the same program for 12 years, right? I mean, what's the way to do this to harness the best in national technology? And is that better civil-military integration? I mean, that's something that the Chinese are very good at. Is there sort of a broader national approach to this that might help scratch that itch?
Yeah, so I think, as you note, you know, some of this certainly is opportunity costs and all of the new opportunities for working in the private sector. But some of it is really just about opportunity and about creating those pathways. So I think first and foremost, it's getting a better sense of what types of technological expertise do we need and at what levels. So we argue, you know, you're going to need a certain amount of that, you know, high skilled technical expertise, computer scientists, coders, AI and machine learning experts that are going to be, you know, building these systems, testing them. But there's also this broader ecosystem and workforce that is going to need some amount of technological savvy and literacy. These are the people that are acquiring the technology, critically operators, senior leaders and decision makers that are going to make the decisions about policy and deployment. And so it is a much broader kind of set of challenges, but also opportunities than just this a subset of technical talent that I do believe will ultimately continue mostly to live and exist outside of the government. So we have a new kind of relationship between industry and DoD where as you know, a lot of innovation is not going to come or start in DoD as it has in the past. And a lot of that work of developing new and innovative capabilities will be started outside the department and live out there in industry, in universities, FFRDCs, et cetera. And so it is first, what is that technology, high-end technology we need? And then what are the other capabilities in areas where we need a basic level of technological literacy? So for that high-end talent, there are a few paths. So first, it's thinking through how do we better utilize the pathways that Congress has authorized to recruit technical talent, particularly cyber talent, that are still far too underutilized. How do you train and incentivize human resources professionals to do that? Second is, there are talk about new rotational programs, fellowship opportunities to bring people from the private sector into government on a rotational or short-term basis. You know, a lot of these people are motivated by solving hard problems and DoD, there are certainly no shortage of those really challenging problems. And if you created pathways and short-term opportunities to bring those people in, we believe that there would certainly be an interested subset in doing so. And then kind of on the broader workforce side of how you retain talent, upskill, develop this broader technological literacy, first and foremost, we argue that there is a range of new kind of commercial technical education opportunities. And so this isn't necessarily about DoD reinventing the wheel, but really surveying the landscape for what is out there and understanding what types of technical education it needs for different components of its workforce, lawyers, concept developers, acquisition officials, et cetera. And lastly, I do think we do place a specific and important emphasis on the acquisition cadre, particularly for acquiring software and other emerging capabilities. This is going to require a really, really different acquisition approach and pathway, one that is way more iterative, that isn't setting requirements and defining them up front, but is taking this approach that really takes in operator feedback, has testing and evaluation built in throughout the development lifecycle. And so there needs to be a specific emphasis on how do you train the acquisition workforce or a subcadre of it to do this emerging technology acquisition? And how do you incentivize and reward a set of behaviors that is requiring a greater risk appetite than perhaps traditional programs would require?
Michelle.
One other thing, so much of the discussion on tech talent in the department has focused on the need to bring more tech talent in from the outside. And I don't disagree with that. I think that's a very important vector. But the department is also sitting on a ton of tech talent, or at least people with demonstrated technology aptitude, that the department does not manage well or use or leverage well. And so one of the things that's interesting to watch is with the Air Force and Kessel Run, and now the Army with the software factory, what you see the services just starting to do is to find those people who already have a STEM degree, who may have a computer science degree, but they've been in logistics or infantry or wherever, starting to pull that tech talent, really focus on upskilling, incentivizing them. One of the ideas I heard the other day was let's pay people for according to how many computer languages they know, not just how many human languages they know. And then, the real trick will be, can you create a career path that allows someone who is already in the force, who does have technical aptitude and increasingly, upskilling what they can do, to stay on that path, to not have to leave it in order to get promoted. So I think there's a human capital management piece that if the services were able to do better, and frankly, OSD were able to do better with the civil servants, there's a lot of talent that can be drawn on there, particularly to get at the sort of increased technological savvy. It doesn't have to be, these people don't necessarily have to be the cutting edge coders. Right. But injecting that savvy into key parts of the system will help it function much more efficiently and effectively, I believe.
I think that's very funny, and I can also understand the value of C++ coders in a universe. I don't know how much C++ we have left, but I suspect it's probably more than we would like to admit in terms of what systems are based on. You know, when it comes to driving change, the United States, some of our most ambitious programs have been driven because we put singular people in charge of them to drive them, whether it's a atom bomb with Leslie Groves, whether it's Red Rayburn or Bernie Shriver for ballistic missile submarines or ICBMs at the end of the day. Do we need to get to that kind of approach where we empower people, give them the authority, give them the latitude, give them the resources, and tell them to do very big things quickly, even if that means going wholly outside the system and up to an Eric Schmidt and say, Eric, here's an X amount of money. You have to redo all of our national battle management systems.
You know, I'm a big believer in role clarity and accountability and empowering people and then holding them accountable for results. I'm not sure that that will work in this case. I think that, you know, you talked about a sense of crisis to motivate change. I think we're there. I think we are in a competition and we can see the horizon, on the horizon, the point at which we could lose our ability to deter effectively if we don't act in a different way. We can see that now, at least that I think the department leadership, the military leaders, the current, you know, several current recent secretaries have had some sense of urgency, growing sense of urgency. The problem is that's not necessarily fully shared at all levels of the building, and it's certainly not shared widely in Congress. There's a core group of defense experts in Congress who get it. But so I think the first thing is you really have to have, you know, again, our, a lot of our final recommendation is about how do you bring Congress inside the tent? How do you help them understand the problem, the urgency, the kind of changes that are essential to get after it, and the risks of not making those changes and sort of try to make them partners. I think you add to that situation the fact that post-pandemic, in the face of a very difficult economic situation and lots of other challenges and needs, I think we can expect a flat or declining defense budget no matter who wins the election, right? I think that's just a reality. That, you know, historically, the Department of Defense doesn't tend to make the hard decisions or the difficult strategic trade-offs in times of plenty, right? Because you can kind of buy your way out of problems and risk. I think the situation we're heading into, or we're in now even, will force some difficult choices. And that's, you know, really hard. You know, it's never fun to try to figure out how to allocate and manage risk. But it's also an opportunity to sort of, you know, make bigger muscle movements in the program and budget. So I do think we are entering a period of real challenge for DOD, and but there's an opportunity to use that to realign the department to start getting you know down the innovation and adoption road with greater speed and scale.
You know, thank you for saying that, but I have to also read what was a brilliant quote. Thanks for getting to the next question succinctly, Michelle, but I wanted to read, I was going to ask, you know, whether, because we as a nation tend to respond to Pearl Harbor and Sputnik and, you know, a calamity, unfortunately, and there are those who are concerned that we've already lost this race, right, that our challenges are such, the financial picture is so cloudy that it's going to be very, very hard to drive that change. The quote I loved it just because I have to feel like I have to read this quote because it was part of the question, but I think it's a very good one. Quote, setting priorities is far easier than deciding where and how to manage risk when resource constraints restrict strategic appetite, which I thought was very appropriate. So you at this point don't think that it's too late as long as the next administration moves coming right out of the blocks in January?
Absolutely not too late. You know, people make tremendous, or people, other countries, potential adversaries, make tremendous mistake when they count the U.S. out. We have not lost this. We can see how we could lose if we didn't play our cards right, but I have tremendous faith in our ability to bounce back from difficult times, and we are certainly in difficult times, to demonstrate tremendous capacity for resilience and innovation and getting after it. But you need a vision, you need leadership, you need to motivate people, and you need to organize them, align them, back them up with resources, empower them, and hold them accountable. And we are, you know, there are problems in each of those areas right now.
Right.
So, but I have total faith in the U.S. military and, you know, the civilian expertise that's out there to get this job done if you have vision and leadership that starts at the very top, at the presidential level, and comes all the way down to the folks who are executing. To me, that is what we're missing. This is not something we can't win. It's something we can choose not to win. Right. And I don't want to see that happen. The stakes are far too high.
What are the puts and takes you would recommend to the next president? And how would you reprioritize resources among the services to better address the threats that we face, right? What are the hardest of the hard choices you think need to be taken by the next administration and taken quickly?
I think that whoever wins in November and comes in January is going to have to do some very rapid and deep scrubs of priority areas to determine whether there need to be shifts and whether there are more cost-effective ways to get the outcomes we seek. I think that Secretary Esper is already doing some of this, but obviously if there were a new administration, they would do their own work in this area. But starting with where we're operational, you know, the looking at operations across geographies and asking ourselves whether our global posture or whether our global level of effort is aligned with our strategy and with this urgent need to invest more in innovation. I think secondly, you're going to have to scrub the most expensive programs. And it's not so much about, you know, well, I would say it's not about walking away from whole areas. For example, you know we need to modernize our strategic nuclear deterrent. It's critical for the confidence in the deterrence, for the safety and security of the deterrent. But there are legitimate questions about whether we can go after that in a way that doesn't cost so much money. And I think those kinds of questions need to be asked. I think for every major defense acquisition program, you've got to find the knee in the curve. You have to find the point at which, when do you, instead of buying the next quantity of a given system, it's going to be more effective for you in terms of giving you the edge to invest that money in all of the capabilities that will make the fleet that you have more relevant, survivable, and combat effective in the future. So instead of buying the extra squadron or the extra battle group or the extra, you know, what have you, you invest in all of the cyber, you know, other defensive systems, munitions, unmanned teaming systems, software, everything else that you need to really substantially increase the capability of the force that you have now. So that those are the kind of big decisions that will need to be made. And I can't tell you the answer because, you know, I think that analysis still has to be done. But it's this, you know, I think the next team will have the sort of program, the mother of all program reviews to do in terms of really trying to realign resources to the things that are absolutely essential to keeping our edge.
We will have the MOAP to join the MOAB. Gabrielle, let me ask you, ask your thoughts as well on this, because we've been covering a little, some ground with Michelle, but, you know, what's your sense, and maybe if I can leave one last question with you, right? How to connect what DoD is doing to the national level? That was kind of a follow-up question I had, but I think ties to the whole piece we're discussing. We're talking about the Pentagon piece of this, and yet there is a very, very important national integration piece of it as well. How the education system ties to the technical talent we need. We're finding that the nation has an insatiable need for this kind of technical talent, and we can't even, and because of challenges with the immigration system, folks aren't able to go overseas the way they used to bring immigrants to the country to be the next generation of great innovator, like a Hyman Rickover, for example. How do you sense how we need to think about the other piece of this that are outside DoD's walls on a national level to bring all of that integration together so that because it's not only about the military power at the end of the day, right? We derive strength across, as Michelle said at the top of this, from all arms of our power.
Yeah, so certainly. So I think that is an incredibly important point. You know, we focus on the military dimension of this challenge, and that's so critical because it provides this foundation of security and enables our deterrence that supports economic prosperity and our ability to protect our interests and allies and partners overseas. But this is certainly a whole of government challenge and is going to require a whole of nation and a whole of government approach. And the competition with China has a military dimension, but it is about trade and economics. It's about technology and who's going to write the rules for 21st century technological governance. It's about ideology and values. So I think first and foremost, we need to think critically, not just about rebalancing and shifting resources within the DoD budget, but how do we rebalance within the broader national security portfolio? How do we put greater emphasis on development and diplomacy that will enable the U.S. to compete with China along these different lines? And then, as you know, this is a moment where DoD can really play its role in rebuilding U.S. competitiveness. And we argue that ultimately the most important thing that the U.S. can do to compete against China is reinvest in the drivers of its own competitiveness. So DoD can play a critical role in funding basic R&D efforts in key areas of science and technology development. It has an important role to play in supporting higher education, technical training, scholarships in critical STEM fields to bolster that technological workforce, both in and out of government. It can help the innovation ecosystem kind of get back on its feet, particularly in the wake of COVID, fueling new high-paying jobs within this broad defense and innovation base, everything from well-established prime contractors to those new innovative startups that we want to bring in to work more closely with the department. DoD has an important role to play in backing and advocating for smart immigration policies that allow us, to harness the best, most innovative workforce we have, talent that is here now and that wants to come to the United States and be part of building this vision. DoD, by setting these big bets and investing resources, really can stimulate new job growth, new opportunities in emerging areas. So it is both how does DoD fit into the whole of government context that is going to be needed to tackle the China challenge, and where can it boost investment competitiveness within the U.S. innovation ecosystem and strengthen our domestic competitiveness vis-a-vis China.
Michelle, any closing thoughts?
No, just, you know, our intent in doing this report was really to stimulate a debate now to be thinking about, again, whoever wins in November, what is the sort of urgent agenda for the Department of Defense going forward, and how can DoD really help keep and extend its military edge and contribute to U.S. economic and technological competitiveness more broadly for the future. So, Bago, thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate the chance to unpack the report and discuss it with you.
Absolute pleasure. Michelle, Gabrielle, thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck in telling the story on this. Hope you guys stay well, and certainly look forward to continuing the dialogue. Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.